My name is Bob Goodkind. Be a member of Friar Cashman recently, and to be able to host Middle East Forum this afternoon. I don't really know very many people around the table. I know one or two. And I think Patrick Clausen, who I'll introduce in a moment, doesn't know everybody either. So why don't we just go around the room and say who you are very quickly, and I'll start in the back and go this way.
David Coder.
Alan Roll.
Albert Goldman.
Lila Heilbrun.
Martin Heilbrun.
Martin Heilbrun.
David Schindler.
I'm Judy Rosen. I'm on the board of the Middle East Forum in New York, and I was one of the original founders of the Middle East Forum.
Great.
I'm especially pleased.
Erwin Growler.
Janet Schriflinger.
Nancy Mandela.
John Leibniz.
Elliot Levy.
Sydney Adler.
Amy Sharkell. I'm managing director of the Middle East Forum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Alex Jaffe. I'm the director of the Campus Lost Project for Middle East Forum.
And I'm Bob Goodkind, and a backer of the Middle East Forum and presently serving as president of the American Jewish Committee. As president of AJC, I had the pleasure of meeting with Patrick Clausen at his office in Washington, D.C. about 6 or 7 months ago. And I know that you're all in for a treat. Generally, among people who know in Washington, Patrick Clausen's the key voice on Iran. I think we're at a very interesting time in dealing with Iran, particularly as the IAEA is meeting within a week or so, and we'll be dealing with that subject as its primary subject. And I know we're all very anxious to hear from Patrick about that and the background of the Iranian nuclear threat. Patrick, without any further ado, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I thought I'd begin by reminding us why the Iranian nuclear program represents such a threat to U.S. interests. The obvious answer is because of the character of the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic's supreme leader regularly says that Israel should be wiped off the face of the earth, as Mr. Sharon pointed out in the General Assembly speech he gave the other day. And it's frightening to think of Iran acquiring the capability to do exactly that. Iran has a long history of sponsoring international terrorism. I'm sure we all remember the hostage taking in the early days of the revolution, the blowing up of the barracks of the Marines in Beirut in 1983, and the blowing up of the Khobar Towers barracks of Air Force personnel in Saudi Arabia in 1996. And Iran acknowledges that some of the key leaders of al-Qaeda are on its territory. Although it says they're under arrest, these people from their arrest places were able to make telephone calls to Saudi Arabia in order to order some of the bombings that have gone on in that country. So we have lots of reasons to worry about the Islamic Republic. But in addition, even if the Shah were ruling Iran and such a close friend of the United States, we still would be very concerned about a nuclear program in Iran. Why? Well, two big reasons. The first is that it could start a nuclear arms race in the region. This part of the world we often think of as, it's only Israel that's got no nuclear weapons. We tend to forget that some of the key Arab players are really not too happy with their status as nuclear-free. Indeed, during the Iran-Iraq War, the Saudis, when the missiles were flying back and forth between the two sides, the Saudis went to Chinese and bought a bunch of long-range missiles from the Chinese. missiles which the Chinese use to carry nuclear warheads. And they're pretty inaccurate missiles. And so nobody could figure out what the Saudis really thought that they were getting here unless they were planning to put something special on top of those missiles. Well, I had disturbing conversations some years ago with a Pakistani general who explained to me in considerable and entirely accurate detail the arrangement that the United States and Germany had during the war, during the Cold War, in which the United States stored nuclear missiles on German soil. In fact, we stored some of our nuclear missiles on top of German missiles. The Germans had the key to the missile, and we had the key to the warhead. And we said that was consistent with the non-proliferation treaty. Well, as this Pakistani general pointed out, if Pakistan were to store some of its nuclear warheads on top of those missiles in Saudi Arabia, then so long as Pakistan had the key to the warhead, even if the key to the missile belonged to the Saudis, that would be consistent with the non-proliferation treaty. But it wouldn't make me feel better. And it would be an extraordinary affront to the national pride of the Egyptians, who are firmly convinced that they are the great power of the Arab world and the great powers of great armies. And many in the Egyptian establishment have always resented Anwar Sadat's snap decision to sign the non-proliferation treaty. And Egypt maintains an impressive nuclear research program. And we'd have to worry that Egypt could decide that it wants to have the exact same capabilities as Iran. So if Iran is going to have a conversion and enrichment program which lets it take natural uranium and produce it into enriched uranium, claiming, as Iran does, it's only going to have low-enriched uranium, which is for power plants, and not high-enriched uranium for bombs, but it's the same technical process of enrichment. Well, the Egyptians may decide that they, too, need to do the same thing. That would not make me feel comfortable knowing that the Egyptians, like the Iranians, would be acquiring the capabilities that put them right on the edge of having a nuclear weapon. Heck, I'm not too comfortable with the Japanese having this capability. I'm certainly not going to be comfortable with the Egyptians having it. And then if once you have Egypt and Saudi Arabia having these weapons, then other people in the region are going to start thinking. At the moment, Iraq's got lots of other things on its mind, but frankly, someday Iraq also is going to want to reassert its leadership role in the region. Especially if things go badly in the Turkish-EU conversation, the Turks, who are getting less and less happy with the United States because they think we're supporting an independent Kurdish state, that there's already been a debate starting in Turkey about its non-nuclear status among the elite. I just don't think the world would be a better place if all of those countries have nuclear weapons. It's a real problem, a nuclear arms race in the region. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why I think it's nuts for the Iranians to pursue nuclear weapons. I don't think nuclear weapons address their security concerns. I think that they would start an arms race that they would lose and they would be worse off. So it just doesn't make sense as a security decision. It makes sense for, say, Pakistan to have nuclear weapons because it has to worry about India invading it. It makes sense for North Korea to have nuclear weapons because they got to worry about if things start going bad in the Korean Peninsula, the South would dearly like to get rid of the North. But it doesn't make sense for Iran. So that's one major reason we would be worried about any kind of an Iranian regime having nuclear weapons, that there could be a nuclear arms race in the region. And the other reason we'd have to worry is that this would seriously undermine the global non-proliferation system, which is getting a little shaky these days, what the North Koreans have done. But the North Koreans have always been pariahs, and they always spit in everybody's eye, and you can treat them as just kind of an odd little country, but if, in fact, Iran gets away with acquiring these very dangerous capabilities without cooperating fully with the IAEA, then we got a big problem here. Right? I mean, the theory has been in our system that we had in place for controlling proliferation that there was a deal. The deal was, if you're open about what you're doing, then you can do some dangerous things. The more open you are, the more dangerous of technologies you could have. And so therefore, if you were really open, you could have this conversion and enrichment. But Iran has in fact, for 18 years, lied to the agency. And the agency, in its last report, said bluntly that after 2.5 years of intense investigations, the Iranians are still not cooperating. And the treaty is very blunt. The treaty doesn't say what the Iranians say is in it. They always say that the treaty gives them establishes their right to the peaceful use of nuclear technology. Well, that's not what it says. What it says is that consistent with the obligations of the first two articles, which are for cooperation with the IAEA and for not having a nuclear program, countries have the right to have peaceful nuclear programs. In other words, that right is a conditional right. And it's right smack there in the sentence of the treaty. It's all in one sentence. It says that this is a conditional right. And if the Iranians get away with the right without having the obligation, without doing the condition, this is going to be a very bad precedent worldwide. And we'll see a fair number of countries that would like to have nuclear weapons in a dangerous world. Taiwan, for instance, has at various times talked about acquiring nuclear weapons, and we have pressed them to stop this. The Argentinians and the Brazilians are the kind of proud nationalists who have vigorous camps interested in pursuing nuclear weapons. And frankly, the South African military think it's a shame that they dismantled their nuclear weapons and would like to restart that, thank you. And since they've already done it once, they know how to do it. So, we have lots of reasons to worry about Iran's nuclear program. Islamic Republic, arms race in the region, the non-proliferation impact globally. What can we do about it? Well, much of the debate focuses on the extreme solutions. Attack or appease. Those are not very attractive solutions. For one thing, they wouldn't work. It's tempting to think that, it's a big problem, and we must be prepared to use military force against it. Well, actually, if we were to use military force against Iran's program, even if we knew exactly where everything was and we were able to knock it all out, history would not stop the next moment. The Iranians would react. And part of their reaction would almost certainly be to redouble, to triple, to quadruple their efforts for this program, and probably to do it on a much more clandestine basis and hidden in tunnels. And it's a big country, you can hide a lot. And so we might find ourselves in a very dangerous situation. Like Saddam, when he was left in power after the Osiris raid, he increased the budget for his nuclear program tenfold. That's why Shimon Peres, to this day, thinks the Osiris raid was a bad idea, because he said that it rededicated Saddam to doing this. Well, I don't agree with Mr. Peres. I think that, in fact, the Israelis stopped that Iraqi program at such an early stage that it was very hard for the Iraqis to reconstitute it. But with Iran, what we face is a country that really has mastered almost all of the dangerous technologies, and so therefore, if we attack it while that regime stays in place, we're going to have quite a problem, thank you. And forget the idea of invading the country to overthrow it. I mean, besides the fact that we're slightly busy elsewhere, if we were in fact to invade Iran, it would probably take us less than a month, possibly even much shorter than that, for our troops to arrive in Tehran, because the Iranian army wouldn't fight. But what it would do instead, what would happen instead, is we would get the fanatics in this regime, of whom there are several million, who would start an insurgency that would make what's going on in Iraq look like a picnic by comparison. So attacking Iran, besides the fact that we're slightly busy elsewhere in the world, might well not work very well. And similarly, appeasing Iran probably wouldn't work very well either. There are some people who think that what we should do is strike a grand bargain with the Iranians, in which if they'll give up their nuclear program, we'll agree to soft pedal all of our other objections about their activities and behavior. And people have proposed that we have negotiations with them about such an idea. Well, let's set aside for a moment all the problems in such negotiations, namely that the two sides don't trust each other. We have a long history on each of the sides thinking the other one cheats on deals and doesn't follow through. You may recall during the Iran-Contra affair, our perception mentioned was that when we sold the Iranians arms, missiles, to get certain hostages freed, they let the hostages go, but then they took more people hostage, right? And the Iranians also read the history of our relationship as that we're not trustworthy. And so it would be very hard to reach a deal. But let's assume we could reach a deal. There's really very little reason to anticipate that the Iranians would live up to their side of the bargain. The Iranian political culture, business culture, personal culture, you always keep something there on the side. And the idea, you know, the comment is made, there are many people in the Middle East who will sell you their mother, but the Iranians won't deliver. It would be entirely consistent with Iranian, the practice of this Iranian government to reach a deal like that and then not carry through. And we would be in a very difficult position because we would not have concrete, specific evidence that they are cheating because we wouldn't want to reveal what our sources are. You get a spy who walks in and tells you all about it, then you blab these information, they can figure out who the spy is and they can kill his family that's left in Iran, and that is not good. So we would not want to reveal how we knew these things, and the world wouldn't believe us. And the Iranians would say, well, you worked out a deal, you got to live up to your side of the deal, we're living up to ours, they would lie. So the appeasement wouldn't work very well. And also, the appeasement would come at a very heavy price because it would mean that we would have to kiss and hug with this regime. They almost certainly would keep up their support for Hezbollah and for Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. And they would also go to their people and say, see, we told you that Uncle Sam doesn't care about things like democracy and human rights and work with us because we've got oil. And so George Bush's hopes of promoting democracy in the region and establishing himself as somebody who cares about democracy and human rights, interesting position for a conservative Republican president, he would look pretty hypocritical. And it would be awfully hard to persuade people in the region that we really were interested in them. So these two extreme options don't work very well. Well, what might work? I would say that the middle options, in fact, are pretty attractive, and there are a whole lot of things that we can do to influence, to deter, and to contain Iran, to say to Iran, that to show Iran that it is worse off for pursuing these nuclear weapons, and that, in fact, it would be better off if it gave up these weapons. I think there are a lot of measures that we can take, even military measures that we can take. So, for instance, if Iran's looking like it represents a threat to the region, then what we should do is we should step up our military cooperation with the countries in the region, and we should step up our military presence in the region, so rather dramatically, to say to the Iranians, you're losing this one, you're starting an arms race, you're going to lose. Therefore, I would be in favor of selling advanced anti-missile systems to the countries of the Persian Gulf to protect themselves against the Iranians. I would be in favor of saying to the Iraqis, who really want to have heavy weapons as well as just a light infantry force, that that's right, we agree with you, we're going to stick around and train your army until you have 1,000 M1 tanks and you've got a serious air force and F-16s and so on. And saying to the Iranians, look, you know, you're threatening your neighbors, we're going to help arm your neighbors. And I also think it'd be good to be out there with the U.S. Navy protecting the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, that's a pretty vital strait, and I'd invite lots of other countries to come with us, too. Part of my aim would be to show the Iranians that they're being isolated by their program, and that this program is isolating them, and that, therefore, they ought to knock it off. I'd also be prepared to offer some positive inducements to the Iranians in the security field. Working with the Soviets during the Cold War, came up with these confidence and stability building measures that worked in the interests of both sides. So, for instance, we were always worried that the Soviets would launch a surprise attack, and so therefore it was in our interest to have an exchange of observers in military exercises, so that we could know that these things really were exercises and not a preparation for an actual invasion. Similarly, I think it would be in our interest to have an exchange of military observers with Iran to observe each side's exercises. I also think that there are other confidence and stability building measures we can do, such as agreements to prevent incidents at sea between the navies of the two sides. That was very successful during the Cold War. We'd had a whole bunch of butt heads at episodes between the ships of the Soviet and American Navy. We signed an incident at sea agreement, and it was in the interest of both sides. So, sticks and some carrots, as long as the carrots are in our interest, are ways in which we can influence, deter, and contain Iran. I want to isolate Iran. If it turns out that, in fact, Iran continues to persist on its path, then I think that we'd be in a good position if we go down this route to working with our European allies to persuade the UN to think about some diplomatic measures to isolate Iran. Now, I happen to think that trying to isolate Iran economically is a dumb idea. We need their oil, and the last time we did oil sanctions on Saddam, it didn't work out so well. So I would hope that we learn from the experience of the last 15 years that oil sanctions are really not such a hot idea. But we had some sanctions in the last 15 years that did work pretty well. If you go to either South Africa or to Serbia and you ask the people or you ask the leaders, everybody agrees that the sanction that we adopted, which had the most impact politically, was a symbolic sanction, namely the ban on participation in international sporting events. Now, Iranians are absolutely soccer crazy. And Iran managed, great day of national celebration when it happened, to qualify for the World Cup, which is being played next year in Germany. If we ban Iran's participation in the World Cup, let me assure you, we will get people's attention. I wrote an article about, in which I made some offhand mention of this, and suddenly the Wall Street Journal writes an editorial about how that would be the start of a serious policy towards Iran if this happens, and that set a record for the number of death threats any institute member has ever received in succeeding days, right? PersianFootball.com had me listed as public enemy number one. There are lots of other diplomatic isolating steps that we have used successfully as an international community, such as banning the travel of the key individuals associated with the suspect program and the members of their family, ordering that the diplomatic missions of the country concerned be reduced in size and restricting the travel of the leaders of that country. And if we isolate Iran, there's a good chance that this will work. Well, why do I say that? Because it has worked. I mean, Iran did agree to suspend its enrichment and conversion activities in the agreement of October 2003 with the Europeans. And frankly, I don't know a single person who anticipated that was going to happen. Not long before it occurred, we'd had a day-long session at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy among leading experts on arms control and on Iran, and we were talking about what were our options and what could we do. And the one thing around the table we all agreed was that the Iranians are never going to suspend their enrichment because it was such a tremendous technological accomplishment and they had such great national pride in it. 2 weeks later, we were all proved wrong. Why were we proven wrong? Because the Iranians did not want to be isolated from the rest of the world. And when the French, the British, and the Germans went to them and said, do this or else, then the Iranians really got worried that there would be an or else. And, you know, they went through a pretty nasty war there with Iraq. I mean, they lost 500,000 people dead. And they don't have any great desire to go through that again, thank you. And so they worry. And so I would say that when we and the international community are united, we stand a good chance of persuading the Iranians to, in fact, freeze their program. They're not going to give up their dreams, and the moment that they think that we're losing interest in the matter, I can assure you that that program's going to work back on the microwave and on the defrost button's going to get hit. All right? But they'll freeze it, I think, if we can stand united. Well, 2 minutes over my 20-minute time limit. Now, question.
Mr. Clausen, I think everyone in this room is concerned about the threat of Iran against the survival of Israel. We know that Iran is not going to try to wipe the United States off the earth, but the Mullahs have already made statements to that effect. How, looking at a worst-case scenario, how likely would that happen if they were to acquire the weapons?
Well, the Iranian practice has been to try to do things indirectly, where they cannot be traced back directly to them in a way that they would be punished. So that, for instance, their sponsorship of international terrorist episodes like the Marine Barracks bombing was always done through cutouts and indirectly in a way that we didn't think we had the proof that was firm enough of the Iranian government's involvement that we could hit back. So they, in fact, tend to be relatively cautious about how they do these things, and cautious about not being hit back. So I think the least likely scenario would be Iranian missiles flying into Israel. I think that's the least likely scenario, just because it wouldn't fit with what the Iranians would want to do, and also because we've worked with the Israelis now for some 20 years on the Arrow program, and we're continuing to upgrade and improve the Arrows and add more of them at a faster rate than the Iranians are improving their missiles. So even if they were to launch these missiles, good chance they wouldn't get there. And I think that Israel has a pretty strong deterrent reputation, saying good chance that they'd fire back. Right? And frankly, if the Iranians were to launch a missile at Israel and the Israelis were to fire back, even the Arab world, they'd say, well, what did you expect? Right? And there would not be much international condemnation of Israel, except the usual ritual stuff. People wouldn't mean it. I mean, come on. Bug. So what I'd be more worried about is that the Iranians would find a devious way to try to attack Israel, and devious routes. But even there, frankly, the fact that the Israelis have got a good deterrent reputation helps, because if the Iranians were to come to the Israelis and say, look, we're not, some hotheads have gotten hold of a nuclear warhead and we don't know what they're going to do with it, and they might explode it in your territory, and unless you agree to a Palestinian state that's in the entire boundaries of 1948, it's perfectly conceivable the Israelis would say, you know, we know exactly what you're talking about. Would you believe it? Some of our hotheads have gotten hold of a couple of nuclear weapons and have threatened to set them off in Tehran. And let's work together and control our hotheads. Right? So, I mean, frankly, the Israelis can be about as devious as the Iranians. And it's a big problem, but frankly, I think that if we work the problem, we can reduce the risks considerably. I said this to the members of the Knesset Defense Committee meeting, and they said, well, yeah, but we'd rather not have the problem. And would you feel comfortable knowing that this was a situation? And I'd said, no, I would not feel comfortable knowing this was a situation, and I'd much rather not have the problem. But I'm telling you that if the problem arises, there's still things you can do to minimize the risk.
I'm going to go right around the table, if I could. Sir, your name again?
Martin Albert. I take it to come in a different perspective. Mm-hmm. One of the problems we're having in Iraq is the Shiites. Mm-hmm. And I think the Shiites need to have a stronger voice in Washington than the other people. So it appears to me that the Shiites are getting their backing from Iran. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be very, very close. And I think it's probably going to look like there's going to be some kind of union between the religious groups and the countries. But don't you view that as a potential threat? How do we solve it?
Well, as so often the case, it's a threat and it's an opportunity, in that we are working very closely with the Shia in Iraq. We're bringing them to power.
Yeah.
And when they really want to be in power, and they're real happy with this situation.
Yeah.
So it's harder and harder for the Iranian government to portray us to their peoples as the enemy of the Shia. And we're getting a whole lot of Shia friends that's creating opportunities for us to learn more and more about what's going on in Iran. And is also, when the Shia in Iran see that the Shia in Iraq can come to power and prosper thanks to American help, that influences their attitudes towards us. So what's success in Iraq, among its other things it would bring with it, would be very destabilizing to the Islamic Republic. And Therefore, the more successful we can be in Iraq, the more likely it is that we can have some impact in encouraging democratic forces inside Iran.
Down the table.
I'm interested in your prescription of isolation, but have some skepticism about it. Another thing is the Indians apparently have indicated that they're not prepared to participate in isolating the Iranians. But I'm particularly interested in the Turks, who are next door neighbors and share a long border, which they have for hundreds of years. Daniel Pipes, who most of you in this room, I think, know, and I shared, we were both delegates in a Nixon Center fact-finding mission to Turkey for a week at the end of May. And among the subjects that we spent considerable time discussing with the various constituencies we were meeting there was this very issue of the Iranian nuclear threat. And peculiarly, albeit within some elites there was concern about this, but peculiarly the Erdogan government has deliberately not sounded any words of alarm. It has not joined with the French and the Germans and the Europeans, let alone with the Americans, in the efforts to pressure Tehran. Indeed, the former foreign minister of Turkey during the run-up to the Gulf War, the chap who tried to extort money out of Colin Powell and who was convinced that if he said no, the invasion would be canceled, observed that, we have had a 300-mile border we've had a long border with the Iranians for 300 years and there's never been any problems. Iranian nuclear weapons would not pose a threat to us, which I think flies in the face of the argument that you made of the destabilization of the neighborhood that would result. But the point, I think, is that the Turks are not prepared, at least in the immediate future, to lend a hand on this. Indeed, they're not lending a hand on much of anything at this stage. The Indians are not. One hardly can trust the French. It strikes me that achieving the kind of isolation that you're talking about is going to be a very difficult goal to get to.
Well, the last resolution of the IAEA board about the Iran issue was unanimous. In fact, every resolution about the Iran has been unanimous. And in the discussion of the last resolution, which got watered down, the Chinese were lobbying for the European draft resolution, which is tougher than the one that was adopted. And so were the Russians. And it's very interesting that the Indian government position is that they agree entirely that Iran cannot be allowed to have enrichment or conversion. They agree. They say, look, right now, Ahmadinejad, the new president, just took office a few months ago. His guys are complete novices. They don't know what they're doing. Give them some more time. Now, that may be hypocritical on their part, but it's not like they're standing up there and saying, as the Indians used to do in the 1990s, that we third world countries are being oppressed by you horrible people from the West, and you just want to keep us downtrodden, and you want to keep technologies away from us, and we have every right to do this. No, they're not saying that. They're saying Iran cannot be allowed to have an enrichment and conversion. But let's not right now take it to the Security Council. Okay, I'm disappointed. But boy, once you agree that there's a problem here, and once you agree that the Iranians cannot be allowed to have an enrichment and conversion, that's a big step forward. And if we can forge a consensus around that, well, it's not as much as I'd like, and I've got to keep pushing to get, once people say there's a problem, you got to say, all right, what are we going to do about this problem? But at least we're in a much better position than we were in the run-up to the Iraq War, where many countries didn't believe us and didn't think it was a problem. If you're in a situation where there's an agreement that the Iranians are a problem, that's a big step forward. And I'm disappointed that the Turkish attitude, which is basically not our fight, but given the state of U.S.-Turkish relationships at the moment, best-selling book in Turkey is describing the United States as wanting to attack Turkey, All right, I'll take what I can get. And in particular, what I've got is an astonishing situation. The French, the Germans, and the British are taking the lead in telling the Iranians, look, you got to do something about this problem. When I came back from the trip throughout Europe spring, and I said to my colleagues, Europeans are not going to fold in this one. They're not going to say to the Iranians, the Europeans had to make an offer to the Iranians about how to settle this matter. I said the European offer, which they're going to make to the new president after he's elected, is going to have zero enrichment, zero conversion. People said to me, Patrick, you drunk too much wine over there. Forget it. It's not the way the Europeans do things. The Europeans are going to say, oh, well, we had to do something. We had to offer them something. Oh, my goodness. And so we're going to allow them symbolic conversion and enrichment, and pretty soon you discover they sold away the whole store. Well, they didn't. The European offer was zero enrichment and zero conversion. Zip. They offered them a whole lot of stuff, and, you know, trade and money, da-da-da-da-da. But zero conversion, zero enrichment. And when the Iranians said no and threw this offer back in the Europeans' face, a lot of my friends anticipated the Europeans would then cave and say, oh, my God, it wasn't a good enough offer. We've got to do something better. And when the Iranians started up conversion and enrichment, they said, oh, well, now the Europeans will definitely, in order to resolve this crisis, they'll do something. Yeah, well, they did. They called up the Iranians and said, we're canceling the next negotiation sessions because there's not going to be more negotiations until you stop enrichment and conversion. At a time when President Bush, when he was asked what was his reaction to the Iranian step of restarting their conversion and enrichment, President Bush said, well, at least the president of Iran is willing to keep on talking. That was President Bush's reaction, and the Europeans the next day wrote the Iranians and said, no, we won't talk to you. We won't talk to you until you stop this. So, I'm impressed. And in the discussions at the United Nations, it's not the United States that's out there beating the bushes in order to get this thing to the Security Council. It's the French, the British, and the Germans. I mean, it's the French president who's out there talking about how this has got to get to the Security Council. The French foreign minister who's having all these meetings about why it's got to get to the Security Council.
Why? Because of the oil.
Frankly, the non-proliferation matters a whole lot. It matters a whole lot to France and to Britain because their status as nuclear powers is a lot of what gives them great weight in world affairs, and they know it. And it matters a lot to Germans who really do take seriously this kind of pacifistic stuff, and they don't want people to have big militaries. They do care about that. And it particularly matters to the current foreign minister of Germany because he comes from the Green Party, which hates nuclear anything. For many in Europe, extremely important at the moment is to establish that Europe has a greater weight in world affairs and can solve world problems. And a problem like proliferation is one of the things which the Europeans have identified as a key problem that they ought to be prepared to solve. Well, they have really stepped forward to solve this problem. The last time they stepped forward to solve a problem on their own, without U.S. help, was they said they would solve the problems in Bosnia. They didn't. That was back in the early 1990s. And they really messed that one up. And frankly, that set back any talk about there being a Europe as a force in world affairs for at least a decade. And they feel this acutely. And they realize that this is the next big test. And if they can't solve this one, then Europe has no weight in world affairs. So, yes, they care about the issue, and yes, they have made this really a test of their status as great powers. So we're in the lovely position of being able to have them be the ones who are doing the heavy lifting. And we're on the sidelines cheerleading. It's a great position to be in.
This gentleman here, let me get Peter, and then we'll be the last two on this side, and then we'll move over. Okay.
Is there anything that the United States should be doing in terms of what I would call soft power? In terms of helping potential opposition to the Iranian regime in Iran?
Well, there are some things we are doing which are really great. I mean, for instance, we have started speaking out more about human rights. During the whole years, though, the reformist President Khatami, many people thought that, well, we don't want to undermine him, don't have to support him. Yeah, this is a thug. No one's got that illusion. And so, therefore, when he, in one of his first acts as president, turned the screws on one of the leading dissidents, and the dissident went on a hunger strike, Bush issued a really strong statement of support for this dissident. I thought that was a really great thing. I mean, this guy is really quite popular among the sort of chattering classes. And we had the particularly delicious phenomenon of George Bush issuing a strong statement in support of this guy, Akbar Ghanji, on Thursday. And on Tuesday, in the New York Times, a full-page ad signed by all of these left-wing intellectuals on behalf of the same guy. Now, it's been a while since I can remember Noam Chomsky adopting the same position as George Bush on the question of international politics, right? But there was, you know, his name, all, that whole crowd, there they were, having paid for this full-page ad, all the leading university professor lights, right? I like that. Works for me. So we're doing something. Other things we're doing with a dripper, and we should be doing it with a hose. And in particular, I find it embarrassing that the Dutch Parliament approved an $18 million increase for Dutch broadcasting to Iran, while the Bush administration is proposing a $3 million increase for its broadcasting to Iran. And we're quite proud of this radio station we set up, which plays popular music for Iranians, which is very popular in Iran. Well, hey folks, everybody in Iran's got satellite TV, and they all watch these absolutely atrocious Los Angeles programs in Persian, because the guys who it's in Persian, they want to see it, and it's something that's not controlled by their government. And let me tell you, those guys in Los Angeles, cuckoo, just absolutely not all of them, but some of the ones who have this. And besides which, they do it on a shoestring, so they don't, you know. For $50 million, if we were to spend $1 per Iranian, $1 per year per Iranian, that would require increasing our broadcasting budget to Iran by fourfold. And that would bring us back up to the level of what we did for the former Soviet bloc during the Cold War days. And so that would be one of the things that I would want to do. And there's some other things we can do to encourage more people-to-people exchanges and so on. But that would be the main thing I would do.
Peter, and then we're going down the end of the table.
When the European...
speak up, Pete.
When the Europeans fail in negotiations with Iran, what should the United States
do? Well, we should look to the Europeans to take leadership about saying, all right, what step comes next? If it's the Europeans who are the ones out there proposing that Iran be banned from the World Cup and that there be political sanctions applied on Iran, it's much more likely to pass the Security Council. If this is an initiative which comes out of the French, the British, and the Germans, and the EU Council endorses it and brings up the Security Council, it's much more likely to pass the Security Council. If it's the Europeans who propose that there be a NATO-GCC exercise off of the Iranian shores in which we have a joint military exercise to protect the Strait of Hormuz, and it's going to be a lot more acceptable to everybody concerned. So what we should be doing is saying to the Europeans, tell us what you want us to do. We'll work with you on this one. All right? And to a large extent, that's what we're doing. Look, so far, it's worked. They got them to suspend the program.
Right? Yes, that's what you think. You've made a long argument that you cannot trust them at their work. So at this point, if that is true, then that is really, to me, hardly reassuring. In fact, just the opposite. I would assume that they're, in fact, carrying on their efforts clandestinely, and that would be a far more, let us say, responsible assumption under the circumstances. But beyond that, my concern about Iran is simply its irrationality. It's not everything that we talk about here assumes reason, and people responding to all kinds of prompts in a way that a reasonable person and self-interest will respond to. If I thought those people weren't nuts, I would say maybe what you have in mind might work. My concern is that they have people, they're including the new president, who does not come out of a tradition of, shall we say, realistic self-interest, that these people are in fact quite ideologically driven. It is what concerns Saudi Arabia and the other Sunni states, because Iran does have a short-term objective of promoting its ideology within the Muslim world before getting beyond, and it's what creates all the anxiety about an Iranian nuclear capability. beyond which, as far as the Germans and the French are concerned, since the Shahab 2, if it's not 3, generation of missiles can now reach France. So now it's no longer simply a question of whether they're going to do something to Israel. These, shall we say, less than rational people would have the capability of actually launching a missile to France, let alone Germany, and someday England, and if they have their way with the North Koreans and how far they can produce this technology, it might reach the day where the United States itself would not be inconceivably not exposing. So we're not dealing with rational people. We know we're not dealing with honest people. And so I'm not entirely clear. I mean, after all, if they're going to be willing, let's say they're willing to set up a nuclear device in Israel, it doesn't seem to bother them they would kill a whole bunch of Muslims as well. There's, you know, it's not exactly like Israel has got a great distance from the wind, force of the wind and nuclear fallout to affect a huge number of Arabs. So, I mean, this is what concerns me. We're not dealing with the rational, and we can't start from that premise.
But perhaps you're right. But I would suggest that a rational Iranian nationalist would be quite proud of what they've been able to accomplish. And that they've done a pretty good job of taking what's a relatively small, relatively poor country, and by portraying it as the leader of the world's radical Muslims, has done a pretty good job of multiplying its power and its force, and attracting a whole lot of attention and a whole lot of allies to it around the world, like Hezbollah, like all kinds of radical Muslim movements that Iran could never have otherwise gotten. And they have had to pay a very high price for this. And that, in fact, they've been able to carry out terrorist attacks without ever having their country hit in retaliation. And so that their policies have been, in fact, quite successful at expanding Iran's national power. Now, they've made some bad mistakes. When they were first came to power and they were threatening to overthrow a whole bunch of their neighbors, that got them pretty isolated. And when they were so isolated, then Saddam thought that he could get away with invading them and stealing a bunch of chunk of their country. And that was a really, you know, it was a really costly for Iran to repel. So they have made some serious mistakes. But I would say that on the whole, their strategy ain't been so bad if they were just had Persian nationalist objectives. And I add to that, you're right, that there's certainly an ideological element to all of this, and they really do believe a lot of their ideology. But, you know, for a Persian nationalist, it hadn't been such a bad regime. And so I'm sure there are irrational people on their side, but there's also a bunch of rational ones who have been, in fact, prepared to do things like stop the war when they were losing it, and to do deals like stopping the overt enrichment and conversion activities. When it comes to that second question, I said the overt ones. I don't know a single person who involved in this issue, and that includes the people at the IAEA and the people in Europe, who think that the Iranians only have the program that we know about. Everybody assumes they have a covert program. Everybody assumes that there's a covert program. But when what we do is close down their overt program, that slows them down a whole bunch. Because they don't just shut down the facility where these centrifuges are. They say, okay, now we've got to figure out where all these centrifuges were made, and we've got to go visit each one of those factories where all these centrifuges were made and go look at all the records of that factory and all the spare parts and all the other equipment that it had and see whether or not they were able to make other centrifuges. And they visited every single place where centrifuges were made and looked at that, at those places and said, were they producing other centrifuges? And they also looked at where all the parts were coming from that went into this and visited those places to see whether or not they were shipping it to other centrifuge-making factories that were completely separate. So I'm sure there is a clandestine program. But boy, shutting down the overt program has slowed down the clandestine program. And it's forced them to spend an enormous amount of effort hiding what they're doing and slows things down. So you're absolutely right that almost certainly is a covert program, almost certainly. But the more in which we are able to get force them to shut down their overt program, the more we have leverage to go and hunt for that covert program, and the more deeply they have to hide it. This morning I was at a press conference with these Iranian dissidents who were presenting evidence that the Iranians have been putting a lot of effort into digging deep tunnels under some large military installations, tunnels where I suspect that they're going to be restarting up these clandestine programs. Well, that, in fact, encouraged me, because it's a whole lot of work to dig those deep tunnels. And they've had to spend several years doing that. It slowed them down. And if they have to do the work in those deep tunnels and they have to build all these complicated air filtering systems which they're installing in these deep tunnels, that's where their effort's going, instead of making making enriched uranium into their air filtration systems to hide these things. So you're right, there's going to be no covert program. But the more in which we can shut down the overt program, the harder and harder we're going to make it for them to make progress in their covert program.
Coming around. Don. What must you really do less with Iraq than our European friends?
Less than Iraq.
Excuse me. Iran's chances of ruling the world are small. But it could think of itself as highly successful if it eliminated Israel as a Jewish state. If France, Germany, and England were pressed with the possibility of Iran articulating a decrease in it, nuclear program in exchange for greater pressure on Israel, say, by first eliminating Israeli presence in the West Bank and moving on from there, say making it not a two-state solution, but a one-state solution. What is your assessment of the European friends accommodating themselves?
First, you understand Iranian ambitions. It is just a commonplace in Iran to say that the Mujahideen brought down the one superpower and that they look forward to them being able to bring down the other superpower. And they are firmly convinced that indeed Muslims are going to run the world. And indeed, I can guarantee you that after the first Million Man March, the headlines in all the Iranian newspapers were a million Muslims march in Washington against its policies. And I'm sure that'll be their headlines after the second such march next month. And they really do believe that 1.3 million Muslims are going to take over the world. And they see themselves as the natural leader of that force. So it's not quite as kooky as they think, as you might think, for them to think that, in fact, Muslims could take over Europe. It's not kooky. Daniel Weiss is concerned that could happen in this century, right? And so the ambitions of really running the world, eliminating Israel is one part of the agenda, but let me tell you, it's broader. It's broader. And after the bombings in London in particular, there is an acute awareness in Berlin, Paris, and London of this fact. An acute awareness that they face a civilizational threat out of this kind of an attitude. It's not altruism that leads them to worry about a radical Muslim power having nuclear weapons. It's not altruism. Therefore, frankly, I don't see Iran limiting itself to just its anti-Israel agenda. It's got a more ambitious agenda than that. And I don't see the Europeans thinking that if they do a deal at the expense of Israel, that they're going to be safe. Right. So I'm not, frankly, that particular deal I'm not worried about. I am worried about the Europeans misleading themselves into thinking that, oh, well, if you've got a process going here, it's all okay. But at least so far, what one hears from the European establishments is that freezing the Iranian program is going to slow down their covert programs and buy us maybe 10 years, that it'll take longer. And some of the most recent reports from the CIA and International Institute of Strategic Studies, which suggests that Iran's program is going slower than we thought, that it's in fact running into problems, are signs of some of the successes that we're having in slowing it down.
I take comfort from three things. According to my estimation,
Banshee was not killed outright and has not been slaughtered or tortured. Well, more than the obvious. That's unusual. Years ago, you would not have seen that. He would have been dead.
Disappeared.
Bye-bye.
Who's that?
Dissident. Number two, the Iranian students, who are known to be dissident and students and upset by the current administration. Again, in Russia, we would not have heard of them. They would all be dead. They would all be paving the streets. And three, Al Jazeera this week says that they are not 1.2 billion Arab Muslims. Sorry, there is 900 million Muslims. Now, what they didn't say is where those other people have gone to, which we extrapolate to mean that they have perhaps converted out, but they're not counting themselves as Muslims. Now, this may not seem like a big deal, but descending in the order of population is rather a big deal because most of those people ascend in terms of their population numbers. So. Am I wrong in thinking those three
are
encouraging developments?
Well, let me start with your last one. What I take greatest encouragement at is that the same secularization that just spread throughout the Christian world, I think, is going to be hitting the Muslim world big time. What we see in Turkey, for instance, is that an awful lot of Turks are, shall we say, Muslim in name only, right?
Well, that seems
I think that phenomenon of Muslim in name only, like people are, you know, like, Christian in name only, Jewish in name only. I would suspect that that phenomenon is going to become much more prevalent throughout the Muslim world, and that globalization will bring a tempering of the radical ideologies over the course of a generation or two. And, so I'm reasonably confident that this is a struggle that we can win if we wage it vigorously and if we support the more liberal forces within the Muslim world. And the more we support them, the easier the victory is going to be, the less costly to them and to us. So yes, I'm generally optimistic about that. I am reasonably optimistic about the democratic movement in Iran, but I have to tell you that we face a big problem, and they face a big problem. And the big problem that they face is that there is a group of people, a number in a couple of million at least, who are prepared to die and to kill to keep this Islamic Republic in power. And so therefore, at least so far, I don't think that the prospects for nonviolent change in Iran are as good as the prospects were in Eastern Europe in the late 1980s or the Ukraine recently. In other words, you've still got a ruling circles in Iran that are committed to the system. In a way, we didn't have by the late 1980s in the Soviet Union. I mean, nobody was committed to that communism stuff, right? So you got a problem. The democratic forces want to bring about change in Iran nonviolently, not only because they don't want to die, but also because they think that the only way that you can really bring democracy to a country is if you have that kind of you have that nonviolent change. And that the very habits of democracy, which require compromise and working with others, really have to be instilled in people, and that requires nonviolent change the way to do that. So as a result, I have to tell you that I suspect that that it's going to be harder to bring about change in Iran than I would like to think. Now, that said, the vast, vast majority of Iranian people can't stand the current system. Very depressed. And if that relatively small group, even though it's maybe a few million people who are willing to die for the regime, if they begin to crack and come apart, then I would think that the prospects for change could become much, much better quite quickly.
Sir, actually, you anticipated my question. The conventional wisdom is that you've got these Islamic establishment in Iran, several million, controlling the rest of the population who are dying for freedom and Western ways. Is that indeed the case?
Freedom in Western ways is a bit of an exaggeration. They're dying for a less repressive government, and they're dying for more opportunities to get on with their lives.
Where were they all these years? Why was the establishment able to do this, keeping the other, say, 48 million people?
Well, the first 8 years there was a war where the country was threatened. And so maybe you didn't like the government, but their very existence as a country was being threatened by this enemy who was invading the place. And that's pretty good for getting people to rally around the flag, right? And then after the war was over, then they started down the path of doing some modest and limited reforms and offering people some modest and limited democracy. And so many people thought, well, gee, change could come from within. But people got pretty sick and tired of that after a while, and that's what led to the election of Mr. Khatami in 1997 and these grand hopes that through elections you could bring in or real reform. There's been a lot of change in Iran since 1997. I mean, it was, social restrictions are dramatically less than what they were before the 1997 election. What's been so discouraging in the last few years is that the hardliners have decided, heck with the people, we're going to rule, that's it, and we're going to set up a system in such a way that we're going to continue to rule. That's been tough. That's been tough. It's been very, very discouraging. Iranian democratically minded people remain very proud nationalists. And if they were to come to power, dealing with them would be like dealing with De Gaulle on his prickliest days. All right? And it can be easy. We're going to have a lot of differences with them. So what? I'll take that.
Last question.
Still, maybe try and hopefully get to the question that will tie together some of the last things we've been talking about. Talk about the hopefully getting to the point where we force them from a covert program, from overt program to a covert program. Estimates talk about that might then take push them back 10 years. If that doesn't give me a usual amount of confidence given how often these things often do with these estimates, but perhaps it's 5 years, perhaps it's 15. What are, assuming we're successful with that, in your mind, and I assume that we all agree that if you could have them have it 2 days from now rather than tomorrow, that's preferable. But as you look out 10 years from now, 15 years from now, what are the odds in your mind that sort of the regime change comes before they get nuclear weapons? What are the odds that even if there is regime change, that they will stop the program, which would seem critical to keeping Egypt, Turkey, perhaps by that point others, from building up their forces. Try to look at the long term. Can you envision a non-nuclear Mideast 15 or 20 years from now?
Look, I think that nuclear weapons are not in Iran's interest, and they don't have a security reason to have nuclear weapons because they don't face an enemy about to threaten their national existence. They're not in Israel's situation. And so, therefore, I think that a democratic government, which cares about isolation from the world, would say that these things are not terribly useful. This government doesn't care about isolation from, it doesn't care as much about isolation from the rest of the world. It still cares some, and I think that gives us some leverage. But this government has decided that it was going to pursue these nuclear weapons and run the risks, having brought off the outside world. So I think we can influence it and change that. So I think that a new government would abandon the nuclear program. And therefore, what we have to do is figure out ways to slow down the nuclear clock and speed up the democracy clock. And can I tell you if there's any guarantee of success? Look, we never get it right when regimes are going to fall. We've been expecting Castro to fall. If you had said to anybody at any point between 1960 and 1988 that the Soviet Union was going to fall apart before Castro fell, right, yeah, okay, come on. We don't get it right either way. We never get it right, right? I mean, there was Jimmy Carter out there toasting the Shah for an island of stability less than 2 years before the Shah was gone. We never get it right. We think the North Koreans aren't going to be around. I mean, we never get it right. So, in fact, I went to a session. CIA has quite an impressive group of university professors who have been looking for a long time trying to develop indicators of what countries are going to fail and what countries are going to have revolutions. And they've been meeting eminent, one of the most famous professors. And the one conclusion they've come to is that in the last 200 years that experts have never successfully predicted revolution. Okay? 200 years. Never happened, right? So I don't think we're going to do it this time either. But I just hope that anything we can do which will slow down that nuclear clock, speed up that democracy clock, it's worth it.
I want to thank all of you and thank you, Patrick, for